Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton of Deerfield Academy, and it's a real treat to be joined today by Amy Brady. She's the executive editor of Orion Magazine and co-editor of The World as We Knew It, Dispatches from a Changing Climate. She's here now to talk about her brand new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. It comes out today from G.P. Putnam Sons. Dr. Brady, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brian.
This is such a delightful book. It is in turns funny and also very fascinating. And it's the kind of book that you could easily kind of get through and devour in an afternoon at the beach. But it's also a book I was thinking that you could really just take months to savor, especially if you let yourself go down every Wikipedia rabbit hole that is present on every single page of this book. And so I had two different ways of reading it myself. But it's just really, really marvelous, and congratulations on it.
Well, thank you so much. Your kind words mean a lot.
I hope we can start with the big picture here. You know, it seems like after you researched both the past and the present place that ICE has occupied in U.S. culture, you've kind of come away with this characterization that Americans' relationship with ICE is, in your words, an obsession. So what led you to come to see it that way?
Well, I had a hunch it was an obsession before I started writing the book. Every time I have had the fortune of traveling abroad, I have asked for a glass of water with ice in it, the response is always a look like there's something growing out of my head. And so, you know, the last time that happened was a few years ago. And when I got back to the United States, I just started to think, well, why am I the weirdo? Why am I the odd person out kind of on the global stage here? And so I started looking for an answer to the question of why do I like ice so much? And it was really hard to find an answer to that question. And so as I started to look more into how ice, you know, shaped my own palate and my own habit, this larger vision or history of ice started to make itself apparent. And it became clear that I am not the only American who is quote unquote obsessed with ice. There are a lot of us out there.
The book goes in so many different directions and it covers so much ground, or, you know, whatever, insert your own ice pun here. But one of the things that it comes back to a lot is social class. And at one point you write that those with gold had access to cold. What are some of the places in history where we most clearly see this interplay of ice and economic status?
Economic status is clear from an ICE perspective from the very beginning of ICE's history. It was a wealthy Bostonian madman who decided to launch the American ICE trade. His name was Frederick Tudor. He came from one of Massachusetts' wealthiest families. And you know, he landed on the idea to start carving blocks of ice out of the nearby lake and ship it to warmer climates where ice doesn't form naturally, or rarely forms naturally. But the thing about Frederick Tudor is that he, as a wealthy Bostonian, already knew the pleasures and comforts of ice because his family owned land, which meant that they had the space to build what was called an ice house. Now, an ice house, it doesn't look anything like a house. It's more like a well that's dug several feet into the ground where large blocks of ice are stored year round. And if those blocks are you know, kind of coated and stacked closely together and coated with sawdust and hay, then they can last all year round. So you needed land. And just like today, back then, you needed a lot of money to have a lot of land. Also, ice harvesting was really dangerous business. And so if you had a lot of money, you didn't have to risk your own bodily harm to do it. You could hire servants or in some cases, enslave servants to harvest that ice for you and your family. So even folks who lived in cold areas like New England, if they didn't have a lot of money, they didn't necessarily have access to ice year round the way that really wealthy people did.
And you mentioned the ice harvesters there. And another major theme in the book throughout is labor. You know, you look across, your book covers centuries, and you describe in many cases the intimate relationships that Americans had formed with ice through work. Who are some of your favorite characters who've come to know ice in that way?
Oh, goodness. Well, on the cover of the book is the stereotypical ice man looking looking pretty sassy, looking kind of jaunty, you know, with that kind of jutting of the hip and the tilt of the head. It was hard work, not just harvesting ice, but delivering it. You know, by the time we get to the late 19th century, ice isn't coming just from lakes and rivers. It's being mechanically produced in large plants. But even at that stage, the ice industry had to get blocks of ice from the plants into people's homes. And so it was done by these burly men who would load the ice into the back of wagons and eventually trucks, and then brought that ice into cities, and eventually into more rural areas, and then would have to carry these 50-pound blocks of ice, sometimes two at a time, one dangling from a pair of tongs and one flung in a burlap sack over their shoulder up 3, 6, 8 flights of stairs, and then heave them into the ice boxes of their customers. So it was really hot, sweaty, dirty work.
And even the Zamboni owners, I mean, the Zamboni drivers themselves have this really intimate kind of knowledge of ice in a way that I didn't fully appreciate beforehand.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for mentioning the Zamboni drivers. They are a great group because they are as proud of their Zambonis are as, you know, I don't know, golfers are of their clubs or guitarists are of their guitar. Like it is like an appendage. they love them. And, you know, they have to keep them, working. And, but just the act of driving those Zambonis, you know, over the ice, they have to be very mindful of the ice's texture and the temperatures and the interplay, you know, between all those thermodynamics and considerations of humidity, you know, and the textures of the ice to make it as perfect as possible for the very specific activity that's happening on the ice, right? Because hockey players, for example, play on a different sheet of ice than, say, curlers do.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to the curlers, absolutely. But we're going to tease that here and leave it for listeners in a few minutes. But that's something else I wondered. You mentioned Tudor and the kind of origins of the commercial ice industry. And you mentioned that there's this later successive manufacturing of ice on its own. And in both of those industries, and then between them, this tension arises around this idea of purity. How does purity, what does it mean in the context of ice, and how has it been defined and enforced over time?
Yeah, so in the mid to late 19th century, when we have the rise of, mechanically made or manufactured or human-made ice, it's still competing with the natural ice industry, right? And this competition is also coinciding with the peak of the Industrial Revolution. And, as all of your listeners know, because they're all history majors or history nerds like I am, the Industrial Revolution was a very filthy time, right? Factories and farms were just letting loose their detritus into the lakes and rivers, those same bodies of water where ice was then harvested and then brought to thirsty Americans who put it to their mouths. And so people got sick. And it didn't take long for scientists to prove that dirty ice was causing outbreaks of all kinds of terrible diseases. And then it also didn't take long for the mechanical ice industry to take advantage of the opportunity and launch a marketing plan to show that their ice, which was created, not in, factory waste filled water, but in an exceptionally clean, factory, was much clearer. It was much cleaner. And one of the ways that they advertised this is that they would take photographs of things that were frozen in their blocks of ice as if it was sitting behind a plate of glass. And actually, a plate of glass is a metaphor that Mark Twain himself used when he visited an ice factory and said that it was like looking through a plane of glass or a glass window by looking through that the frozen, the things that were frozen in blocks of ice.
Wow. And ice does, it is mentioned briefly in the Pure Food and Drug Act, right? This is 1906 or whatever. But it's like a slap on the wrist, right? If you have selling tainted ice, is this right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the laws around serving dirty ice to Americans were very scant, especially in the early 20th century. And even they weren't all that well enforced. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. One is just that, the FDA barely existed if at all at that time. But then also the people who owned the ice companies were really powerful people. They were the robber barons of the early 20th century. The Carnegies and the Mellons of ice.
And then it's really, from your telling, I think it's the industry that starts policing itself, right? That it comes up with industry standards and these associations. And there's I don't know what the names of these places are, but these ice manufacturers associations, right? That they set the standards themselves because they're worried about the fallout.
Yeah. So that actually started to happen a lot later. Kind of in the late 20th century and into the early 21st century. Yeah. Where they finally started to set some kind of rules and guidelines for the people of their own industry so that it became a badge of honor, if you will, to be able to put on your bags of ice that you're selling that you belong to this regulated industry. And the reason for that is because ice doesn't have recognizable brands the way that, say, soda does, right? Like there's not really a Coke and Pepsi of ice. And so the fear is that if people were getting sick on ice, they would assume it's just an industry-wide problem and not just because there's this one ice maker in the back of, a mom and pop convenience store who hasn't cleaned their ice maker in 30 years and, serving dirty ice that's making people sick. And so by putting this badge on there, the industry people who belong to this organization are agreeing to a certain degree of cleanliness and standards where their ice making and distribution is concerned.
That's so fascinating. And one of the last places we see kind of a valence of purity coming up in your book is contemporary mixologists in kind of high-end cocktail bars in lower Manhattan and pursuing the clearest ice cube they can get. What can you tell us a little bit of that story?
Yeah. So As somebody who can really enjoy a nice cocktail, I could say even before researching this book that good ice makes all the difference in a cocktail. If it's clear ice, it's just the cocktail looks better and it tastes better. And much to my delight, and it was also kind of an ego stroke reading this book, some very fancy and important mixologists confirmed that decision. And so what has really been the case for, you know, the last 15 or 20 years or so is that, you know, bartenders at, you know, higher end establishments are seeking the clearest ice possible to put in their drinks and often to make their drinks with. And they get their hands on this ice in all different kinds of ways. You know, some of them have ice delivered, you know, every morning, which is kind of a throwback in some ways, right? I mean, there's still ice men who deliver ice. And some places also have what's called a Kleinbell machine, which is an ice making machine that produces perfectly clear and very large blocks of ice that the mixologists or the bartenders then carve themselves into whatever shape is desired for the drinks that they're serving.
That's great. There are so many parts of this book that made me like yell in the next room to my partner or text my friends. And did you know this? And there's so many origin stories that you just never would have under, Holiday Inn, they come, you know, all these things. I think my favorite one is the 7-Eleven origin story. Mm. Without spoiling the whole book, could we share that with listeners if you're willing to give it away? Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. So mechanically made ice cropped up in the southern United States. And there's all kinds of reasons for that that go beyond just geography and climate. But ultimately, one of the companies that started creating mechanically made ice was called the Southland Ice Company. And, you know, they sold ice to customers, you know, day in and you know, day out, you know, to people who were, you know, either coming directly to them for ice, but often when people who would stop to get ice would be coming from like a grocery store or something. You know, ice back then was just kind of like stopping to get gas, right? You just always needed to replenish it. And one of the savvy managers of Southland Ice Company Depot was somebody who kept hearing over and over again, his ice customers saying, "Man, I wish I had remembered to pick up that gallon of milk. Now I need to drive back to get it." And, or, you know, "Shoot, I forgot that loaf of bread. I'm going to have to go back to the grocery store." And so what he did was he started stocking these household staples alongside the ice that was for sale. And customers loved it. It suddenly became this one-stop shop for just kind of a weekly refresh of their kitchen. And other Southland Ice Company, depots started to repeat that same model, and it became quite popular. And, you know, the grocery stores hated it because suddenly they were starting to eat into their business, and they made a big stink about it. But the Southland Ice Company knew a great business opportunity when they saw it, so they kept at it. Well, eventually they became so popular that they had to extend their hours, and they extended their hours to 7-Eleven in the morning, 11 o'clock at night, and eventually rebranded to become the 7-Eleven stores. And so the Southland Ice Company actually was the model for the first convenience store as we know it now. And that's why, you know, almost all convenience stores still sell ice. I mean, convenience stores were a place where you would go for a bag of ice long before grocery stores were.
Oh, and it's just hiding in plain sight there, because of course, like, we all buy ice, you know, in the summer, whatever, picnics at a convenience store, but it is it has an old timey feel to it. You're buying it outside from that weird chest and you're bringing it inside usually, or you're paying first and then going to pick it up with an old key. And it just, yep. And it's like, oh, this is why this feels so weird. But this is how it all began as well, which I think is just so fascinating. And then also, there another factoid, maybe a public service announcement here, is that you can get bags of ice at McDonald's, apparently, in all these the fast food stores.
A lot of them. Yeah. I don't know if it's 100% universal, but a lot of places. And I know a favorite in my family is Sonic, because Sonic has that pebble ice.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which I've heard some people just refer to simply as the good ice. Yeah. And you can, yeah, you can go and get a bag of it for like $2 or something. It's great.
And this is all still holding on to that culture of picking up your ice as you go.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
amazing.
Absolutely.
Love it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So the first half of the book is deals with kind of the rise of commercial ice and how people have consumed it in different forms, past and present. And then you pivot quite hard into looking at ice-based sports and then other uses of ice that are not going down our throats. And so can you talk a bit about maybe about process, about how soon did you know how many places this book would go? Like, did you have the architecture pretty early on or not?
I didn't have the architecture set super early on. I think I knew early on what the highlights were going to be. Like, what were the most interesting parts of the history of ice that I wanted to make sure got told? And then I worked backwards from there to figure out, you know, what is the best way to tell the story so that we end up at the point that I really want readers, you know, to take in. And, you know, eventually I just realized there was, you know, there is, as you say, there's this history of the emergence of the ice trade and of commercial ice, but ice also plays this outsized role in our history of food and drink and in the sports we play and in medicine. You know, and it also has a very important role in how we think of, you know, air conditioning and how, you know, that is now taking a toll on the climate. These are all really important things. And I knew that I couldn't fit all of that into the same story that I was telling about the rise of commercial ice. So I decided to break the book into four parts where, you know, the first four chapters have its own narrative arc of this is how the ice trade led to our understanding of ice today. And then the three other parts are about how ice plays this outsized role in these very important aspects of our everyday existence.
Yeah, great. It's really great. And the ice sports chapters are all fascinating in and of themselves. And there's the backstory of the origin of Madison Square Garden began as an ice arena and all these things I didn't understand. And Barnum makes an appearance as he has in almost every book about U.S. history, but in another surprising way. He never runs out of surprises. But let's go to the curling chapter, because first of all, you got to curl, which I think is wonderful. And I think we all want to hear about that. Also, I never talk about curling in an odd numbered year, and this feels very strange, but I'm excited to. So I'm sure curling was maybe an early obvious one when you were going to do sports. But what was it like to acquaint yourself with that world?
Well, curling is so much harder than it looks.
Oh, nobody wants to hear that.
I mean, you know, I, like everybody else that I know anyway, I get really excited about the curling sports in the Olympics. Like the women curlers, you know, of this most recent Winter Olympics was just, they were amazing. And I loved watching them. And this is very egotistical in retrospect. As I was watching them play, I was like, you know, compared to some sports in the Olympics, I think I could do that.
It's the last vestige of our Olympic dreams. We put all on curling, right? We could get there, maybe, you know.
Yeah. Like maybe that one's still within my reach. And then I went to my local curling club where they put me in the shoes that you wear for curling. They gave me you know, all the equipment, and they were just like, you know, just send the stone down the sheet. Just doing that took me 30 minutes before I could do it without, you know, losing my balance and falling flat on my face. You know, I mean, I'm sure there are people who can catch on quicker than I am, but I'm not the least athletic person in the world. But even that, it took me a solid 30 minutes to be able to get it right just once. And even then, you know, the stone didn't get anywhere near the house, which is the target at the end of the sheet that you're aiming for. So it's a very difficult sport to play. And I have renewed respect for all of the Olympic athletes and non-Olympic athletes that play it.
Wonderful. And you go deep into the physics of curling. And, you know, is it that we don't know what, you know, I love the persistent kind of persistent mysteries of science today. Like, I think we don't know why hiccups happen or something, that kind of thing, you know. Well, we also don't know why curling stones curl, right? I mean, or there's quite a voracious debate about this. Is this right?
There's a lot of debate why curling stones curl the way that they do. There's nothing else that we know of on Earth that functions quite like a curling stone, right? So when you know, for example, you know, if I were to take, I'm going to hold up a can in front of the camera here, okay, so that you can see it, Brian.
For radio, yep.
Right. I'll describe it for the listeners here. You know, when you send a can, for example, kind of down a slick space and you give it a spin, right, it actually, the arc of its trajectory goes in the opposite direction in which you attempt to spin it. And that's the way most things function on Earth. But with a curling stone, when you send it down the sheet, the proper technique is to give it kind of a very slight curl. When you give it that twist, it actually takes the curve in its trajectory follows the direction in which you spun it. And nobody quite knows why. You know, there's been some thought that, you know, there's something about the way that the friction is operating in the front of the stone. There's other thought about the ice itself, since curling ice is something called pebbled. It's not a perfectly smooth sheet. It's actually intentionally made a little rough. But nobody, as of writing the book, at the time of writing the book, nobody has come up with a definitive answer for why curling works the way that it does.
I don't have a good segue here to go from curling to carbon, but that's the book ends with some really important chapters on thinking about the carbon implications of refrigeration. And you report that the cooling industry produces by itself 10% of global CO2 emissions, which you measure as half the amount produced by the airline and shipping industries combined, which is just massive. I mean, we know these are energy, you know, intensive machines, but it's just the scale of it is bigger than I'd realized. So how did we get there? And we got there quite quickly. And then how successful have conservation efforts been to date?
Yeah, well, I'll say now that cooling is combining, you know, air conditioning and refrigeration, and I do focus mostly on refrigeration because that does play the outsized role here. I'll start by saying conservation efforts, or, you know, at least in terms of kind of reducing the energy draw of refrigeration, is actually much better now than it used to be. But the history of refrigeration is pretty wild in terms of its carbon output, because, I didn't realize until I was researching this book that the first company to standardize refrigeration, which, by the way, was hugely important, right? And because before we got to the standardization of refrigeration, you know, any company could make a refrigerator, but you couldn't find a replacement part for it. Right. And they all frequently broke because they were often these bespoke made machines. So the first company to come in and standardize it had to be a really big company. And that company was General Electric. Now, why do you think General Electric wanted to get in on this new electric technology?
Not to keep my meat cold, I don't think.
Keep your meat cold. No, it was to their bottom line. And so, you know, as far as, you know, they were concerned, you know, refrigerators should draw all the energy. And they kind of did. I mean, you know, just like today, they were among the most significant drawers of energy in, you know, any given American's home. And so, you know, it really wasn't until, gosh, like the 70s and 80s when California built, when California passed governmental standards, state standards for refrigeration, that things started to change. You know, it took a while, but the Reagan administration eventually implemented those standards as federal standards. And then, about a decade after that, the Energy Star program was launched. And, now we actually have refrigerators that are significantly better and more efficient than they were certainly 100 years ago, but even 30, 40, 50 years ago. But we still have a ways to go. They are still major energy draws, especially if they have an automatic ice maker in them, because those automatic ice makers never shut off. You know, that's why you can get ice but at 3 in the afternoon or 3 in the morning.
And you reminded me of a moment before everyone has one in their home, or most Americans have them in their home, where there was a period where we had communal commercial kind of ice lockers that you would go and you said like a safety deposit box or like a storage locker today.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. It's wild to think about, right? I grew up in a house, and we were not a wealthy family, but we still had a standard fridge and freezer. And then we had another standalone freezer, right? For all the meat that you got from Walmart, and you could just, because it was on sale, at a ridiculous price, and you could keep it for weeks or months at a time. Back in the, as late as the, 1950s, that wasn't the case. People still use, like you said, it was like a storage locker, and they would go and they would take something out or put something in and then lock it up and then drive back home.
Fascinating. Your book concludes with a really eye-opening exploration of methane hydrates, which you call flammable ice. Why did these compounds serve as a fitting end to the story you had always planned to kind of get to the end here?
Well, methane hydrates are not the same kind of ice that comes out of our refrigerator. It's a very specific kind of ice. It's actually a frozen ball of methane, which is a very potent and powerful flammable gas. And these kind of balls of frozen gas, when you put a light to them, they'll catch fire. And that's why a lot of people call them flammable ice. These balls of methane form, in relatively, shallow areas in the ocean, like the continental shelf. Some of them form also under frozen tundra. And what scientists have been exploring for more than a couple decades now is the possibility of harvesting them and using them as a bridge fuel to help wean Americans and people in other countries off of fossil fuels so that we can enter a greener future. There's a lot of tension and controversy around that. There's a lot of people who, and I completely sympathize with this perspective, who want to skip the whole idea of bridge fuel and just move straight to green energy. There are other people who feel like it's just dangerous to harvest methane hydrate, because if you, their thinking goes, if you dissociate them or disturb them so that they break apart, that they will release methane, into the air. Now, there are other scientists who I quote in my book who say that's actually not a worry we should really concern ourselves with, because if, first off, like this idea that, we're going to break open some methane hydrate and there's going to be just like this shooting spew of methane into the atmosphere, this isn't going to happen. If we do break some open, the amount of methane that it releases into the atmosphere is a fraction of what humans do. So let's focus on our own human activity here if we're going to worry about spewing carbon or methane into the atmosphere. It's, it's a really interesting possibility. And, the reason why I wanted to end my book on it, to answer your direct question, was because, the book ultimately poses a question after looking at this long history of ice and how it's led to the rise in electric refrigeration and how, through that change is starting to take an extraordinary toll on the planet. The question at the heart of my book is it possible or even ethical, for us to have ice in our kitchens and ice on our planetary poles, right? And so, what can we do? And this is one solution. And I thought, how interesting that a form of ice is one possible solution to the ice problem.
Well, today, as Pub Day, this is a day to celebrate with your favorite cocktail on the rocks. It's unfair to ask this question about future projects, but I'm wondering, after you're totally sick of talking about ice, if that day ever comes, are there things you imagine taking up other topics in the future?
Oh, thank you for saying so. Well, I will say I am largely occupied by my work at Orion.
Right.
And so if you don't mind me making a quick pitch, let me
Please.
Just say, if you like environmental books, you'll love Orion. It's America's best environmental magazine. We've published some of your favorite writers. I'm so excited about the work that's coming out in that magazine. But for me personally, you know, I'm actually right now at work on an essay about maps. I'm fascinated by how, maps in one way kind of demonstrate man's dominion over the land, but in some cases actually are obscuring the damage that we've done to it. And I'm just kind of leaning into that contradiction a little bit to see what I can learn.
Oh, that's great. Well, we'll keep our eye out for that and for every future issue of Orion. But this book, again, is Ice: From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. It comes out today from G.P. Putnam Sons. Its author is, and my guest has been, Dr. Amy Brady. Amy, thank you so much for your time today and for this book.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.